Hello, and today on Meaning על המשמעות podcast, תמיר דורטל is joined by Dr. Victor Davis Hansen, a prolific military historian, renowned classicist, and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution to discuss what happened when the West sacrifices its tents on the altar of progressivism. Hansen, who authored The Cringe and Culture, Landmark Battle in the Rise of the Western Power, examines the consequences of abandoning the principles that guided the West to victory for thousands of years. So let's get rolling.
על המשמעות, פודקאסט פילוסופי פוליטי.
Hello, Professor Hansen. It's a great pleasure for you to be here.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You're a great historian of war, and I wanted to ask you, why is war such a field of knowledge that is people don't really study it in university, and it's not sexy, and people don't really want to study it?
Well, I mean, history was synonymous with military history in the beginning. That's what Thucydides and Herodotus were. They were military historians, as well as Xenophon. And their idea was that time accelerates during war, and people do things that they otherwise would not. And things change much more quickly than during peace. And so, therefore, when you look at war, I think Thucydides said, you see human character with the veneer stripped off. So it's an insight into the human condition. While it's not popular in the West, it was... I have to clarify that. It's very popular in bookstores, in book clubs, in popular reading. So if you write a book on, say, the Vietnam War or World War II, it will sell far more than a book on politics or sociology, for the most part. People want to read about it, but it doesn't have an academic pedigree anymore. Military history programs are waning. And part of that is the Vietnam War, when people... collated war itself with United States imperialism. It accelerated during the politically correct period in the 80s. We had a lot of wars, Yugoslavia, Somalia, especially the wars in the Middle East. And the left, again, branded war in general, but the United States participation in particular as, imperialism, neocolonialism, people who were of color on the receiving end of white imperialists. And then the woke movement has sort of suggested that everything is a matter of race. So even the Pentagon is now talking about ferreting out white privilege, white rage. So all of these ideologies and isms, utopian pacifism, moral equivalents that are prominent in the West, they make it very hard to talk about war as a phenomenon that occasionally solves a problem. I think in earlier times, World War II, people felt whatever the 65 million people who were killed, it was tragic, it solved the problem. And that Vietnam and subsequent wars did not solve the problem for which they were intended.
Do you think that the USSR has tried to subvert America from within? As Yuri Benzemov, a former KGB expert for subversion, said that because the USSR knew that they can't beat America economically or in the war field, so they have tried to take America from within, to take the American spirit and the American and the sense of righteousness and the pride to be an American.
They did that in the immediate post-World War II period. There was a lot of people, for all the excesses of the demagogue Joseph McCarthy, there were a lot of people from Alger Hiss to the people who worked on both the atomic and the hydrogen bomb project, the Rosenbergs, and people in Hollywood who felt the Soviet Union was a better model than the United States, and they worked actively. That kind of petered out as the Soviet Union became an open enemy of the United States, and that they suffered a lot of career detriment. And then I'd say that the Soviet Union's propaganda was so crude in the United States, they didn't have a lot of effect. They're not nearly as adept as the Chinese. The Chinese are able to take the rhetoric of the left, and even though China is a uniracial state, very racist, has Uyghurs in camps, locks up African Americans, you know, periodically when they're worried about COVID, they channel back that the United States is racist, unfair, xenophobic. We saw that a little bit with radical Islam. They tried to do the same thing, bin Laden and Dr. Zawahiri. They published pamphlets that the United States was not behind climate change, or the United States was not fair to feminism. But they were much cruder. The Chinese have 380,000 students in the United States, and they understand popular culture far better than the Russians or the Islamists. So that's a much greater threat right now, that I think that China understands that the United States, this woke revolution, is a war against meritocracy. It's a war against values. It's a war against deterrence. It's a war against classical military readiness, and they understand that.
It's funny, because if we talk about China or the former USSR, they are a meritocracy, in the sense that what they tell us to do about diversity and about low discipline and about inclusion in schools and in our organizations, they don't do themselves. They want the best students to excel, and they want their best people to be in the highest spots. They don't care about diversity or inclusion. It is really hypocritic of them. And I think that we should learn not from what they tell us to do, but from what they do.
Yeah, I think that's true. They understand, they see us, and they're delighted as sort of adopting their pre-reform policies at Maoism. We have commissars, we have ideology. Not that they don't at the very high level. If you want to be a general in the People's Liberation Army, you're going to probably have to be a party member, and you're going to probably have to know the right people. So their top echelons still work on that basis of ideological purity, and that brings in incompetence. But their delight when they look at the United States is they thought, oh, wow, they're politically correct. We did that with Mao and the Cultural Revolution. They're having a cultural revolution just like we did. And we hope that we can encourage it, because we know what it did to us. And so that's pretty much what their propaganda is about. They love bringing fentanyl across the border to Mexico. And then they'll say the United States is restrictionist. It's racist. It doesn't let poor people from the South come into their country. And they'll think it's militaristic. It oppresses black people. It's xenophobic. They have a propaganda point that white people, the majority of the culture in the United States, are attacking Asian Americans. And we know that's not true. Hate crimes are committed about three times more by people of color against Asians than not. But that's the type of thing they do. And they get it, they channel it from students in the United States that are aware of the popular attitudes on campus.
Your main thesis, if I read it correctly, on your book Carnage and Culture, that was translated by Shibboleth Pressing into Hebrew, it's called Nitzchon HaMa'arav, is that the Western tradition of war, which is better than the other traditions of war that the West have fought against. And could it be copied? You say it's a matter of culture, but if the Chinese, let's say, would read your book thoroughly, can they copy-paste your points about the Western culture and do it in their war? If we are talking today about might be a war between the China and the U.S., Taiwan is in a big threat. What can they copy?
In the short term, yes, they can, and they've done it. So almost they've leaped 50 years ahead without the commensurate research and development investment, because they have stolen or appropriated illegally technology from Europe, the United States, and other westernized countries. And so, yes, they're doing that. They have, if you see their uniforms, You see their military academies, they're copied almost lock, stock, and barrel from the United States Military Academy. So it's not just, they're like the Japanese were, say, 1900, where after the opening of Japan, they sent 250,000 students into Britain to learn nautical technology, and then to France and Germany to learn how to form an army and a modern army. And by, you know, just 10 years later, by 1904 or 5, they blew the Russian Navy out of the water. And by the 1930s, they were overrunning parts of the Pacific on westernized principles. But long term, they don't bring in the same culture of dissent. They see that as a weakness because it goes into excess. So they ultimately, in the case of Japan, they did not have frank discussions about whether they should attack Pearl Harbor or not. Yamamoto just said, if I don't get to attack Pearl Harbor, I'm going to resign. And then it was just a question of, nobody really questioned the Japanese admiralty, the wisdom of that. Or when they went into China, that was a very stupid thing to do, given their other ambitions. So there was not a lot of strategic, tactical, diplomatic discussion as there is in the West, and which can get excessive. But in the long term, it's of some advantage. And I think you can see that when China makes a military decision to do something, if Xi says we're going into Taiwan, and a lot of generals or diplomats or university people say, here's why we shouldn't, all of that will be out of the public realm. And the people who will make those recommendations, many of them will make it on the basis of whether they have career enhancements by doing so. Whereas in the West, that's a human trait, but it's going to be more transparent and frank. And there's going to be people in the West know if this is not sound, there's going to be an anti-war movement. And so it tends to give you in the long term, if it's fully developed, it gives Western countries, it doesn't mean they're going to win. It just means if you look at the whole menu, logistics, capitalism, free speech, dissent, scientific technology, rationalism, it means that they can exercise political power that's not commensurate with their population or resource. It's beyond that. And so I don't think any other, take the humiliation of the United States in Afghanistan. That was a blunder of the greatest order since Vietnam. But I doubt the Chinese could have taken that many troops and plopped them down in Afghanistan for 20 years. Or a better parallel was, could they have an expeditionary force and have gone into Bolivia for 20 years? Well, that I don't think they could. So the United States and Western countries have this ability to overcome numbers or climate or distance more so than other cultures. It doesn't mean they're going to win, but it means they have a lot of advantage.
In this book, Carnage and Culture, you give a great emphasis on conquering the land instead of defeating or killing as much enemy as you can. Why is the land is so important? You are talking about the Vietnam War, the Tet Offensive, and you are saying that those troops that were inside of the territory, all surrounded, they just wanted to keep the land in their hands, they would die for it. And the American generals told them after they kept the land, you know, we don't need it anymore, let's retreat, after we won the battle, but we lost the war. Why is the land is so important?
I think people don't understand that we don't live in the air and we don't have houses in the sea. So why do we have a Navy or why do we have an Air Force? And that is to enhance the ability to take land and hold it. And why does the United States have an Air Force at all? It's to stop other people from using their Air Force to attack our troops on the land. Why do we have a Navy? The same thing. They're not ends in themselves. You can have the greatest Air Force, and you can, if Israel obtains air superiority, which it has over Syria, that's a wonderful thing. But ultimately, what's the aim of that? The aim of that is to preclude a Syrian invasion into Israel, to grab land and to kill people on land. And so that's the purpose of these. Sometimes we confuse it and think they're ends in themselves, or they're punitive. we can go in and bomb, but ultimately, if we bomb, we're telling someone you are confined to a particular space, or you're not going to go out beyond that space, or you're not going to travel from that space. And that's because the land is where people live and where they operate. In Vietnam, we didn't quite understand that. We just thought we're going to punish these people. We're going to bomb them. But we never asked, are we going to kill them and I'm going to leave? Or we're going to obliterate every living thing around the Quezon Air Force Base, and then we're going to pull out. But that missed the point. If you occupy land, you have control of a country, and you can control a people. And so that's what war is ultimately about. It's taking or holding or preventing somebody from coming into your space, ultimately.
So what happened to our generals? Didn't they went to West Point, to the best academies? I'm sure they read your books or some of your books. What lost in the way?
We had, in World War II in Korea, we actually had very good generals, and they were well-trained, well-read, and they understood that ultimately, you couldn't just bomb Germany. You had to go into the European continent. You had to free Western Europe, and you had to physically go into Germany and occupy that space. The same thing was true with Japan. If you didn't do that, if you just bombed Japan with an atomic bomb, or you just bombed it with fire bombs, there was no ability on the ground to mold or warp or change what they were going to do, and they'd be back again. So that was the idea. I think what happened is they became two things. They became slaves of technology, and the more sophisticated air and sea power and even artillery and things were, they became ends in themselves. And they thought, you know, we can put a cruise missile through a window in bin Laden's house, but they never quite understood, or we can kill Dr. Zawahiri, but they didn't understand why Dr. Zawahiri was in Kabul. He had a physical space because we abandoned it and we didn't keep a base there. Had we had a base there, we could have gone and picked him up months ago, or we could have told the Taliban, you're not going to do that. And so they forgot that. The other thing is, in the modern postmodern world, in constitutional societies in the West, they're very affluent, they're leisured. And the idea of anything that's optional, whether you have a draft or a volunteer army, the idea of an optional war, something that's preemptive, something that's distant, you have a very small window of operation time-wise. If Israel wants to go into Syria, if it wants to preempt and have a bombing campaign against Iran, if the United States wants to go into Iraq, as soon as you start that, the clock ticks, because it disrupts the Western lifestyle. It's contrary to a lot of Western bromides and pieties. And so you've got to be very, very careful about how quick you do it. And it has to be, I think a lot of times the generals don't understand. They think that courage and victory and defeat are ancient ideas, but they don't understand that when the United States went into Iraq, in 6 weeks, they toppled the government, they controlled the country, they knocked down the statue in 3 weeks. 90% of Americans supported that. When the insurgency started, within a year, there was only 40%. And that was because they felt we had won, we achieved the mission, now what? Well, we're staying there. Okay, did we control the country? No. We can't shoot somebody because we're not in a war, we're in peace. And so that dragged out for years, and then it lost all support, as did Afghanistan. So for Western armies from very affluent societies, you've got to be very quick, and you have to understand the asymmetry. When you go over to a poor country, your own population will begin to be sympathetic or you have this problem yourself with disproportionality, where war is based on not being proportional. So if somebody shells you, you have to take out not the artillery platform, but five more. But when you do that, people will say to you, well, these people were very poor people. They were conscripts. You went and blasted them apart. They didn't know what they were doing. Why did you do that? There was only one artillery platform that fired at you. Why didn't you just take that out? Why are you doing this to people who don't have the opportunity and the advantages that you do?
And what would you tell those generals or those platoon commanders or whatever? You would tell them, this is war. This is the nature of war, and we need to win unproportionally.
Yes, you'd have to tell them that you didn't invent the rules because it's based on human nature. So the person who fired the rocket at Israel, the degree to which he will fire another rocket depends on endangering or not endangering everybody in his entire rocket brigade. And so if he fires and you fire back and take him out, people will say, well, at least, you know, he killed five Israelis, so he got killed. But if he knows that he's going to endanger everybody, not that you're going to be indiscriminate, but you're going to be discriminately targeting five people, and so they don't do it again. And so I think Israel understands that it has to be disproportionate. And if it is not, then the other side's greater number of people or territory then starts to weigh against them, because they can bring that into the equation. So Israeli defense doctrine is based on, we have smaller spaces, fewer people, but we're going to reply in a way that is unpredictable and is going to hurt more people than just the perpetrator, and therefore we're going to have deterrence. And it has worked pretty well. And when you don't do that, then it doesn't work well.
Actually, maybe Israel should conquer the Gaza Strip. You said we should have boots on the ground.
רציתי להציע לכם להפיק סיפור חיים מרגש לסבא וסבתא. אז אם אתם גם רוצים להפיק תוך זמן ממש קצר סיפור חיים שכולל את כל החיים מלידה ועד זקנה, ולשמור את כל הסיפורים הכי טובים של סבא וסבתא כדי שלא ילכו לאיבוד, תפנו אליי 0505-77-0586 ותקבלו הצעת מחיר. להתראות.
It depends on what's in your interest. If you feel that you go into Gaza and you think it's a valuable piece of territory and that there are moral or political or legal rights that you can make in the world forum for your own particular advantages, yeah. But if you think it's the most crowded place per capita per square mile in the world, and it's full of a miasma of social, political, hygienic, health, all sorts of problems, and you don't want to be the overseer of that, then it's not in your interest.
About 2 months ago, you were in Israel at the Israeli Conservatism Conference, and one of the most fascinating points that Caroline asked you was about the privileged progressives who are really rich, and they are against charter schools, and they are against strong borders. But those policies are not going to hurt them. They are going to hurt the common American, the low-skilled laborers, the blue collar. And I want to emphasize this question that Caroline asked you, and to take your call about it. Why are those rich progressives are so in favor of policies that are going to hurt their own people?
I think we're seeing that now. After we just saw the last week that the mayors of major cities, Washington, D.C. in particular, that have been vocal about opening the border are now screaming to high heaven that the governor of Texas is busing people who cross the border right into Washington. And given the rhetoric of the Washington political class, they should want those people because it's diversity. Washington is about 75% African-American and about 10% Hispanic. So when you bring people of color in there, they would like that, you would think. But they don't. They're very angry. And the answer to that is much of the whole Western left-wing mind is based on it's different than the old Stalinist or Marxist idea that you're going to be, you know, equality of result and you're the working class. It's mostly a boutique ideology of the very wealthy or the very educated. And they tend, because of their privileges, to be separated from the working classes. And they become afraid of them, or they feel they're not authentic or they're not genuine. And so what they do is, from very safe places in the university or the media or the corporation or professional sports, they virtue signal, they performance art, and there are four things in the abstract. They don't think, why do we need a wall? This is so oppressive. But if you go down the Pacific Coast Highway in Malibu, every single megaphone of open borders has a huge wall around their home. Barack Obama says, you know, we need to radically change the American economy because global warming is going to inundate all of our coastal places. Now he's building a several million dollar home on the beach in Hawaii. He just got a place on Martha's Vineyard on the coast. John Kerry says we've got to outlaw all combustion engines in 10 years or so. He flies on a private jet. And I could go, same thing with charter schools. Everybody who doesn't like a public charter school, almost to the person, their children are in private academies. So it becomes a psychological mechanism to say that they're not segregationists, they're not privileged, they're not racist, they love the underclass, the romance of the underclass, and that allows them to live these privileged and positions. Because you would think that Barack Obama, for example, who calls everyone a racist still, a filibuster is a racist, Donald Trump's a racist, but he's got a mansion in Chicago. Why doesn't he just go back to Chicago and continue to socially organize and community? He won't. He has three mansions in the most white, secluded areas in the United States. So I think that's a lot of it. It's a psychological mechanism to square the circle of living one way and feeling bad about it. And so on the cheap, trying to justify it by condemning people in the abstract.
But they are not just condemning. They are actually getting forward those kind of legislation and those kind of,
yes,
of bad things that are going to happen in the real reality, and that is going to really hurt the people's lives. If they were just talking, we wouldn't have talking about it.
But they never argue on the issues. They never say the following. This is how much another mile of the wall will cost. This is how much illegal immigration will cost. This is how many miles that we built that people have tried to cross and couldn't. They never use data. So they always argue emotionally. And they say, this is racist. This is exclusionary.
A lot of adjectives.
Yes, that's designed to preclude all discussion. Because they don't. And why do they believe these things? They believe ultimately when you peel off the onion, you get to the core. And they believe their primary, in your country and in Western Europe, the primary ideology is people need to be radically the same. They have to be equal, and they have to do it on the back end. They're not equality of opportunity. It's a quality result, and that requires massive government intervention into people's lives, into finance, economics, culture. But to do all that requires an overseer, a platonic guardian class, somebody who's like the Soviet elite or the Maoist elite or our elite or your elite. And they have to have certain privileges to be able to exercise such power because they're good people, they're prophets, and they need to have private jets, and they need to have walled estates, and they need to have chauffeurs, and they need to be treated. And they hate the middle classes who have poor taste, they feel, and are unthinking, and they romanticize the poor that are at a distance. So that's pretty much how the West works, unfortunately. It's always worked that way, but there were ways to, you know, we've never seen so much wealth in so few hands in the West under globalization. That's and the left now is always the party in most countries of the very, very wealthy and the very poor. And the middle classes tend to be conservative.
A question that gets to the heart of the difference between conservatives and libertarians is a question that was also thought by Adam Smith. Adam Smith says that certain industries must remain domestic, and that the nation should not allow itself to become dependent on imports from other nations. At the conservative conference, you pointed out that the raisins industry, as an example, should not be imported or should not import from the EU, even though that the EU has subsidized them heavily, and we could buy them really cheap.
because it hurts farmers like you. Why so?
Yeah, I'd say that when people are libertarian and they believe in free markets, they usually believe in free markets for their own people. And they'll say things like, if we have a free market, and if we bring in cheap products on any field, from raisins to screwdrivers, there's three things that can happen when you lose. One, you'll get angry and do it cheap, more cheaply. B, you'll go out of business and somebody better will take your place. And three, they won't be able to subsidize that continually, so they'll go broke eventually because they're not meeting you on a fair playing field. And usually, those are all long-term considerations. So the EU, for example, will take traditional agriculture in France or Greece, and they understand that per acre output and a cost-to-benefit analysis, even with the shipping cost, is about three times higher than what the United States can do. But they will subsidize that because they say this particular village in Greece or Spain or France is a whole nexus of children's little leagues or hospitals or seven generations of culture, or it's scenic or it's picturesque. And we in the United States say, if it's not efficient on global standards, out it goes, and it can be replaced by something that's more profitable. And when you say to them, but that's not the way the world plays, then you say, but look how much wealthier we are per capita than they are. And then you say, yes, but if that's true, why are these communities so much more stable, or they have less crime, or their life expectancy is a little bit better than ours? So there are certain qualifications that are not predicated just on per capita income. You try to tell that to people. I'm speaking not abstractly. And so when you talk to diplomats or political officials, less so now after the Trump years, but before it was, well, we have a burden after World War II because it fell upon us. We didn't want the role to make sure that most nations in the world had free commerce, free communications. At least there's an international rules-based order. And we defended it against the fascists and Nazis, then the Soviets, and then the Islamists. And it's never going to change. And the United States is going to have to bear that burden. And part of that burden is that our allies, because they're not going to be fully armed, they're going to be a little bit better off in terms of subsidies for their products. And so Germany has very high duties on American pickups. They don't buy a lot. We don't have very high duties on Mercedes. You can buy many foreign cars in the United States cheaper than you can the country that made them, because they're intended for export. But if you tell Germans that, they'll say, well, you know, that was your job. You're supposed to protect Europe and you're supposed to protect the West. You're an imperial power. But the problem is, it's 75 years from World War II, and that message has not been inculcated in each generation. We've got $30 trillion in debt. Students have $1.7 trillion in college debt. And a lot of them and our birth rate has just plummeted from 2.1 down to 1.6 in just 20 years, one of the fastest drops in American history. It is the fastest drop. And so a lot of people are asking themselves, what is in the interest of the United States to be expeditionary and go all over the globe and try to kill the bad guys and then help the good guys, when A, the good guys are sometimes not much better than the bad guys, and the good guys help you and resent you. They hate you and resent you for coming over there. And I think we're also learning, the left is learning, that you can go over to Afghanistan and have pride flags and George Floyd murals, and that's a form of cultural imperialism itself. And they're learning that a traditional Afghan hates you more than they do a right-wing guy who, you know, builds a road or something.
The point that I didn't get at this conference was why raisins is such a strategic industry that you should keep in the US. And, like, because you are importing it not from China, but from the EU, the EU is your biggest friend. Why would you care to import something from your biggest friend and to be dependent on him on something that, even if it's strategic, it's not so bad to be dependent on your friend?
Well, a couple of things. Friends are friends are friends. They're not always friends. 90% of our antibiotics are made from China, and those contracts were created at the turn of the millennium. And people said, the Chinese are our friends. They were fighting the Japanese. We've never had a war, really. We fought them in the Korean War, but that's the only time. They're friendly people. They're trying to be like us. We've got to be friendly with them. We'll go over there and give them joint projects. And then it ended up that if China stops tomorrow sending antibiotics to the United States, we won't have any. They create 70% of our Tylenol. As far as raisins go, that was a different question. That, you know, it was largely Spain and Greece. And the idea was, why do they tax American raisins coming into their country, and then they send tax-free subsidized raisins into our country?
Yeah, so good for you. Good for you. If I give you a present, so good for you.
Good for us, meaning, we'll put it this way. Good for us. The raisins were clearly inferior to ours, because I'm not just saying that they were. They didn't meet the same standards. But good for us because they were cheaper, or they made us sell us. Sun-made raisins had to be sold cheaper. Bad for the people who grew them. So I'm in a little barn, and I can tell you that in a 360-degree area, 40 years ago, there was 50 small farms with families, three generations living in the same house. They had 100 acres. Their children were all in the high schools. They came. They were city council. There was a very vibrant community. Every single thing has been wiped out. There is no farm now. There are three people that own all of this, and it's farms that are about 10, 15,000 acres, mostly almonds. They're very, very productive. They're nice people. They're huge corporate. So all of those houses now are rented out. They're not kept up. They're not painted. And they're inhabited by people here illegally from Mexico. So over there was a family that had three great football players, 40 acres of raisins. That is a house on a huge corporate farm that's rented out. Nobody knows who lives there because there's gang members, there's 30 dogs, they're not vaccinated, there's all sorts of illicit activity. That's what it is now. So the cost to the community and the country of destroying the middle class is and having an absentee latifundia plan with a bunch of very, very poor people from a different country that don't even speak your language. And so when I used to go out to my mailbox, I would wave at tractors going by, or somebody would come by and he'd say, Victor, you know, I've been sulfuring all morning. Can I have a cup of coffee? Come in and have coffee. It was that way. People didn't lock your door. Now, when I see somebody walking, he's got a Glock 9 in his belt. He doesn't speak English, and he's got, you know, he's walking around casing out places to steal. And I can't call a sheriff because they don't want anything to do with him, because if they arrest him, we're in a sanctuary city and they can't deport him. So that is why Europe has tried not to be purely libertarian.
Yeah. We were talking before about demographics, that the U.S. Demographics has fallen really dramatically. And I wanted to ask you about what's the connection between demographics and being religious or being secular. Maybe you think it can be upside down, like that America would come back to be a Christian religious country once again, like Alexis de Tocqueville saw in his visit in the 19th century.
היי חברים, מה שלומכם? רציתי לספר לכם קצת על הפודקאסט הזה, על על המשמעות שאתם מקשיבים לו. אני כבר מעל 3 שנים מקליט, 2 פרקים בשבוע, מעל 250 פרקים, ומנסה להביא לכם את מיטב המוחות, אבל מה לעשות? צריך גם להתפרנס ממשהו. אני מאוד אשמח אם מי שיזין לפודקאסט ונהנה ממנו, יתרום בין מנת פלאפל, מנת שווארמה או כל דבר כזה או אחר, עדיף בהוראת קבע חודשית. יש לנו גם פודקאסט למנויים בלבד, למי שתורם לנו כספים. על המשמעות פלוס, שבו יש כבר מעל 60 פרקים שזמינים רק למנויים. אז הצטרפו אלינו לעל המשמעות פלוס ותעזרו לי ממש להמשיך בעבודה שלי בשבילכם. תודה.
Yeah, I think there's a direct, and people have pointed that out, in a direct relationship in a variety of ways. One is when a person believes in transcendence, when they die, there's something else. That also permeates the idea that they want to leave behind something there to a family member, or they feel there's a life beyond this one. And so they care for their children. They want children. They want people to be continuity. They're not shiftless. If people are tending to stay more in one place rather than be so mobile, they tend to want to acquire property and to pass it on. And so that religion is very important, and transcendence is very important, and also affluence and leisure. So if American young women and men feel that they're in a, you know, they're sort of metrosexuals, and tonight they're going to go to a rave, and then the next night they're going to go to a club, and then they're going to have friends over for dinner. Each hour that they have to change diapers or worry about strep throat or ear infections takes away from that. And or if they're young and they have a lot of material aspirations, housing is very expensive. They feel, if I have one child, then I'll have to get a bigger home. I'll have to spend $1 million to get a child from birth to 18. I'd rather spend it on myself and my own appetites. And then finally, the old paradigm that you change your children's diapers so they change yours. So I'm quoting from Greek aphorisms. That doesn't apply anymore when the state has appropriated the responsibility for older people with all of these long-term homes. So now the young person thinks, well, when I get ill, I get old, they'll just put me in a home and I don't need my kids to worry about it. And I don't need kids. So we've destroyed all of the ancient incentives why people, whether it was acquiring property for the next generation or having leaving a mark behind you. But when you're an atheist or agnostic or sensualist, or you're very mobile, that's what the Western, it's not just us. It's every society and every religious community in the United States, whether it's the Amish or the Mormons or Catholic, they tend to have about 3 to 5 children per family.
So at the beginning of what you said, I wanted to blame the wealth, and then I wanted to blame the government. So who's more to blame, the wealth or the government who took the place of children who are taking care of the elders?
It's hard to know the both, but popular culture also, because they in their messaging and their advertising, it's all about, you can even see it. I'm not being unfair to young people. It's even when people get older in this generation, if you look at ads in popular culture, it's not, I'm 70 now, I sort of had a full life, I'm going to stay home and have leave something for my children. It's, these are your golden years, you worked hard enough, you should get a luxury vacation, you should have a third home, you should have this. And you see people, you know, these little signs that we're spending our children's inheritance that they put on their Winnebago or something. So there's an idea that each generation wants something for itself because they don't believe that there's anything after this. They don't believe life is, they believe that this is heaven. And religious people tend to believe this is hell, and when you die is heaven.
Well,
that's an exaggeration.
No, but this is a great point.
Yeah. And that means that you're working for the next world. And part of that responsibility is to replace yourself and to leave, especially if you're a religious community, you feel that your community, if each person, I often think that I had two brothers, and then I had an adopted first cousin too. There were 5 of us. So we should have had altogether 10 children, and we had 12. And those 12 should have had 24. And out of the 24, as of now, there's seven. Seven. And you can see in every family what's happened. Seven. So we did not replace ourselves. We did, barely. Our five of us had 12 children, but the 12 children did not have 24 children. And that shows you that, and that's true of every family. We have a, you probably have seen it in Israel to a lesser degree in your secular communities.
Actually, in Israel, there is a renaissance in the secular communities. The demographics went from 2.1 to 2.3. So we are
that's great.
on a great shape in Israel.
Yeah, you can see, though, but in the West in general, that there's an epidemic of prolonged adolescence, where especially young males here in the United States and in Europe, where people stay home in their 20s and 30s, their parents take care of their needs. They date, they go out and party, but they're not marrying, having children, and fully employed, buying a home in their late 20s, as used to be true.
So actually, really looking forward to see a renaissance in the West, and particularly in the United States, because I think that the world as we see it today is America has a really great part in the prosperity and in the peace and in the ability to take your ship from Israel to the United States to China and then to Russia. It's the peace in the seas. People don't really appreciate it, and don't.
No, they don't. They don't understand the United States plays a role, especially for nations like your own, but for places like Armenia or Greece or the Kurds or smaller countries that have humane systems that are in, like Poland, or places that are in bad neighborhoods, and people around them want to destroy them. And they're not always on a geostrategic global sense able to be secure. In the United States, indirectly or by inference or sometimes overtly, protects those people. And it's the only country in the world that does that. If tomorrow Iran sends a bomb into your country, the United States will try to knock it down, or they will try to help you do something about it. If Turkey tomorrow invades Thrace or tries to steal the Aegean Islands, the United States will try to do something about it. And that's just the way it is. And there's no other country in the world. There's countries that would like to do it, but they do not want to spend the money and detract from social spending. So the Netherlands or the Belgians or the French, they say all they want, but they're not going to have the wherewithal to be able to help. And just the way it is. And the problem with that is it requires the United States to educate its own people on why they must have a strong defense, and why that is costly, and why you can't have these cradle-to-grave entitlements, and why that's not good for you anyway, and why people will hate you when you help them, and why people are jealous and all that. But we're not doing that. So it's kind of scary.
Yeah, so Professor Hansen, I really wanted to thank you for your time and effort, and really keep writing, and your book, Ukrainian Culture, was great, and I am sure that many lives were saved because of this book, because it really taught me as an Israeli officer what is our tradition and what is our war culture in order to win wars. And I wanted to thank also Yehuda Segal, a friend of mine that coordinated this interview. So thank you very much for your good work.
Thank you for having me. We'll see you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
על המשמעות, פודקאסט פילוסופי פוליטי.